Today on Rockin' the Suburbs...
Jim, these countdown weeks really are a lot of fun. Not only are the shows a blast to do, but I really enjoy counting up all the votes for different songs.
It's definitely a sign of the podcasting times.
Whatever that means.
I don't know.
It's got a Prince song title in it.
Yeah, that's right. All right, we're in Wednesday of Prince Week. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And so you are coming in as we are into the top 10 now on the Prince Countdown.
Yep.
So just a quick reminder, we recorded this all in one session. It was actually the night before Labor Day. And we had a bunch of people on a virtual event. And so you hear from those people from time to time. And it was a listener vote. And we just counted down the best Prince songs or the favorite Prince songs, right?
Yeah, totally. And as we mentioned, so wide-ranging it was. And this is where we start to get into, the real kind of the meat of the top 10 and where you start to really say, is my song going to make it or how high is it going to be? So,
All right. So with that, let's hear the countdown. Let's move into the top 10 now with number 9.
Hurricane Annie ripped the ceiling off a church and killed everyone inside. You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. My sister killed a baby because she couldn't afford to feed it. It was sending people to the moon. In September, my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's doing horse. It's June.
Times,
man,
another good slow jam, kind of like Pop Life, but this one has more weight to it. The lyrics are more important in this one. Yeah,
a little bit more. Mark Neese, when he voted for this song, said Prince attacking social issues head on, just a total banger of a track. So he's getting it. I guess controversy may have been a foreshadowing of this, or just another extension of this part of Prince's artistry. But totally. Shaking your ass on the dance floor, but also, thinking at the same time.
So I want to call on Gerald Jasinski here because he put in the chat that he thinks this is one of the most important songs of the 80s decade. Gerald, are you there?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, as Patrick said, he's tackling social issues head on. I mean, he wasn't afraid. He came right out and said, the fact is the man died of a big disease with a little name. By chance, his girlfriend came across the needle, and soon she did the same. Mm-hmm. AIDS was everywhere. AIDS was just up and coming.
Yeah.
The U.S. were in the Reagan era. Neoconservatism was throughout globally at that point. We had Brian Mulroney, U.K., had Margaret Thatcher, and a lot of people were struggling. And we had the war on drugs, and street gangs were becoming more of a thing, and Prince just tackled that head on in this song and said, look, this is what is happening to America, Canada, the UK, worldwide, and we need to do something about it.
By the way, that's great. That's really well said, Gerald. And I'm sorry that while you were doing that, Patrick was like packing for a trip or something.
I just had to check on something.
Oh, all right. Okay.
But I was thinking while I was doing that, and this is the, I think one of the most interesting points that it's hard to remember if you went through it, because I think as a people, we have a tendency to forget the bad stuff when it's over, or like we feel like we've gotten somewhat through it or gotten a handle on it. But the AIDS crisis for an artist like Prince, who, it, you know, in his early records, espouse this incredible sexuality and getting right in touch with your sexual side, and then suddenly this was part of it too. So, you know, well brought up by Gerald, and I think it's important to remember the times that a lot of this music was made, at least the tunes we're talking about today.
Totally agree. And I think, you know, you made a good point about like the song like Controversy. I mentioned Pop Life. Like Prince would always, he sort of, had these songs where he was kind of dancing around the edges a little bit around, you know, social issues or, yep, or bigger themes. But yep, in reality, most of his songs were about, you know, yeah, like you said, like relationships, sexuality, mm-hmm, yep, you know, just more, more intimate, personal sort of stuff. Right. And, here we have, you know, him just taken head on, like the world. It just, this song feels like the world is, yeah, is just, you know, coming down on you as you're listening to it, right?
And without a doubt.
The yep other thing too, I think, is and I do think, and this was one that I got to appreciate in real time. I mean, I had this, I bought this album when it came out. I listened to it a ton over that summer of 87, and it just felt so like vital. You know, yep, the whole album did, but then, you know, this song being the title track really just set the tone for it all. The other thing that's cool too, when I hear a song like this, is I just picture him just sort of like crafting it by himself, you know,
yeah,
in, you know, at Paisley Park or whatever, just, you know,
totally,
just sort of like playing it all, going back over, double tracking, doing all this stuff. And it has a certain sparseness to it, but it's just so like perfectly done, don't you think?
Yeah. Totally agree, Jim. And, you know, fitting that the guy, you know, one of his early notable tunes was called Let's Work, because, man, did this guy work hard. I mean, he was constantly writing songs, constantly working, completely dedicated to his career and his image and his artistry. And there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, the dude supported like an entire, you know, three other bands by writing and producing them. It was unbelievable the amount of work he did and how incredibly talented and focused he was.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that he did all this stuff.
Completely. And you mentioned earlier a comparison to another Minnesotan, Bob Dylan, and this song is kind of Dylan-esque too, in a way, don't you think?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's a classic Dylan move to sort of vaguely mention a situation, but don't mention it so specifically that your song becomes so dated that it's gone, right? You know, Prince never did that. Dylan never did that, you know, for the most part anyway. And it's a smart trick. The Clash didn't do it either, you know? So.
Right. All right. This song went to number 3. That surprised me when I looked that up today.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think a song quite like this. It's not a, you know, it's not particularly poppy, or it doesn't necessarily feel radio ready, you know, for that. In that time, radio airplay was the thing that you had to have. But yet it caught on to listeners and went to number 3. So
amazing.
Good on him.
Yeah, and he was just in that zone at that time and was such a commercial force and artistic force that critically and, you know, at the record store counter, he was huge. And it was kind of one of those things you had to buy to make sure you were up to date.
We're going to move on. Number 8 on the countdown.
Down.
very different song, right, from what we just heard. This
yeah,
is just
totally and
straightforward. Not a lot of interpretation here. You know what it's about. It's got this that awesome like late 70s groove to it, and it's not really disco, but it has a little sort of disco guitar touch to it. Just a great R&B tune, right? I think is what it is.
Yeah, totally. And I got to say, earlier on this podcast, I think I said, oh, I'd never heard anyone sing falsetto. That was so cool. But then Jody Gersh put in the chat, proving her genius once again. Bee Gees, duh. And you do hear a little Bee Gees in this. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. There's a tiny bit of that kind of Saturday Night Fever, better than anything on Saturday Night Fever, probably. Like a more danceable, cooler tune, that's for sure.
Very cool. Maisie, do you want to speak up for the podcast? You said this is your favorite song.
It's one of my favorite songs. It probably is, but I just feel like this is the kind of song I'm always in the mood for it. Anytime it comes on, I will never turn it off.
Right.
Sometimes you're not in the mood for everything, but every time I hear this one, that's it. I will always listen to this and I will always turn it up. It's just fun. I don't know.
It's one of those. Yes. You could be, any kind of bad mood and you could put this song on and you're like, you feel better.
Yes. Right?
Completely.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we can all use that right now, right? Because it's...
totally.
I mean, everyone can use a good mood right now. So I'm down for this song.
It's like one of those movies, like no matter what mood you're in, if you're flipping around and you come across it or you stop on it on TV, you're like, I'm going to watch this for a little while. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, totally agree. And, Jody also said a little bit of Michael Jackson vibe. So, you know, Michael Jackson probably off the wall. I can't remember. It was probably around the same time. And I think another case of Prince showing he could do whatever he needed to do to sort of make a hit record. And, you know, the cover, it's pretty classic. Jim, you have the mustache, but not the hair. It's pretty close. Would you mind taking your shirt off?
Yes, but... but yeah, it is a great album cover. It's great. Prince, a handsome man, that Prince.
Yeah. The second record too. I mean, again, amazing, to be able to, sign a contract with a major label, as a African-American artist from the Midwest and, get creative control. Pretty impressive in the late 70s. So, he obviously showed direction, vision, and commitment to his art. Early on. I mean, Andy Warhol once painted this man, Jim. We have to.
That's right.
That. Yeah.
But I want to say one thing, and maybe Ed Bowser might have some perspective on this too, being more of a student of R&B, but Prince came in, you know, this was his second album here. And if you go back and listen to the first one too, you can hear little touches of disco, but he never went full on disco. And I think, and I'm not saying anything bad about disco, there's a lot of disco songs I like. But I think that may have helped him in the long run because of the disco backlash that happened, right? That he was not grouped in with those artists.
Yeah, you got to remember the era. Disco was not the business by the time Prince started picking up steam. And the thing that I've always loved about his music is that he's always taking elements of everything. Mm-hmm. So it's almost impossible to put him in one genre because he borrows from everything. So it might be a touch of R&B, so the R&B lovers like me will be like, oh, okay, I kind of like this song. Or he'll throw a dash of rock in. Later on, he played a little bit with actual rapping and hip-hop. So that kind of really gave him his unique flavor. No one could be like him because you couldn't keep up what he was doing next.
Well said, Ed. And why do you think he was like that? Do you think it was just because he was trying to show that he was so intelligent that he could play a little bit of everything? Or do you think he just really loved and truly appreciated all those different styles?
Both. I think both, some of it is just Prince being Prince and being like, I can do what you can do even better.
Yeah.
But he just had such an appreciation and love for music in general across the genres. I think he couldn't help it. He just wanted to participate and to sample a little bit of everything on everyone else's plate.
Yeah, totally. Well said.
And was it you, Patrick, who mentioned earlier Rick James? I think that's probably the closest comparison for a contemporary, you know, for one of his contemporaries, right?
Right, totally. I think Rick James was one of, you know, the artists that he kind of inherited a mantle from. Prince ended up carrying a heavy weight on his shoulders, as we all know. But he did inherit the mantle of Jimi Hendrix and also Rick James and, you know, a bunch of other people, too. And he shouldered it proudly. you know, we're not going to get into sort of his life and life story, but right. you again, Ed said it way better than I could. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
All right. Somebody in the chat here talked about MTV and what an impact that had on Prince. And that's so interesting that you would bring that up now, because now we're going into song number 7 here on the countdown. All right, 1999. So I remember this, of course, from MTV. This was probably, this album was my introduction to Prince. And it's amazing to think that this was his, fifth album? Fifth album by this point, right? And this was, but this was really, I mean, he was moving toward success before this, but I mean, this was it, man. 1999 album was the breakthrough for Prince, right? That's when he reached
exactly
the stratosphere.
Right, Jim. Yeah. Yeah, the total first flowering of his commercial success, and probably his what you would call classic period, as I was saying, and also the closure of an earlier period where he sort of proved his artistic vision and his, you know, his genius, and also when he began to get really free to me in his music. And I probably say this in hindsight. I know when I listened to it, I just loved it, but I wasn't sure why. But the fact that you could trade off lines from female voices and you could say something like, I was dreaming when I wrote this, so forgive me, you know, like I'm just going with some sort of instinct. Just this record is really free and acknowledging, you know, a harsh reality, like the century is about to turn and I'm imagining what that's going to be like, you know. And again, like Prince, thinking way ahead of everyone else, you know, probably 10 years ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So for when this came out in 1982, 1999 seemed like the distant future. Like we would all be, you know,
seemed like 2001. Yeah.
It was like jetpacks and that sort of thing, right? And so the idea to party like it's 1999 just seemed like the coolest thing possible. Now in 2020, wouldn't we all like to party like it's 1999, right?
Hell yes, we would.
Completely different perspective, but.
Totally.
But yeah, it holds up in a different way. Yeah, you mentioned the trading off of lines, so we should give some credit here, because there's not a lot of Prince songs where this happens, but he shared vocals with Des Dickerson, Lisa Coleman, and Jill Jones on that, and I read that originally it was supposed to be like a three-part harmony thing, but it wasn't working out, so they just decided to just sing the lines separately.
Amazing that he would have that flexibility. I mean, kind of like Ricky was talking about it, obviously he was... his creative radar was on full blast at all times, and he just knew what felt right, and he went with that. Interesting that, and I think this is really fascinating, Harris wrote on his ballad, Harris King said, I saw Beck on the Midnight Vultures tour, and I am convinced he was recreating 1999, the album, with his album and tour. So, again, one thing we haven't really talked about, Jim, right, is his influence. We've talked about the fact that he supported other bands, but his influence is probably there's no way you can measure it, right? I mean, even more than Hendrix or Rick James, you could not possibly measure Prince's influence. Yeah.
No, because he influenced people from across genres. Right. You know,
just like Ed was saying, he was saying, I can do this and I can also show you my appreciation. So that just casts the net so wide. Yeah.
I will say, yes, a huge influence obviously in like sort of like R&B and soul, but even in like indie rock, you know, there's indie rockers who are into Prince and incorporate that into it. And you mentioned a guy like Beck. I mean, that's a good example. Just everywhere. Like there's so many people who love Prince and who cover his work today and do it in different styles. And it's like immeasurable, really. I don't think we can quite quantify it in a 2-hour, you know, recording session of this podcast, Patrick.
No, not with our brains. And also, I got to say, so right on point. I mean, one of the songs on my top 10, I learned that Prince did it because I heard an indie rock band cover it on a B-side of their single. Never knew it was a Prince song until I went back and found it.
So there you go. I will also say that riff is so simple, but it's so effective, isn't it? Right? That dun, 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 dun. It just like goes back and forth between those two chords, and it's just so perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
And totally. then again, the percussion sounds, I don't know how they developed all of that. Yeah. It sounds, a lot of it's sort of electronic and so on, but it's like, it just sounds like a party, you know, which I think is important to this song because it's a party song, right? So it has to sound like that.
Totally, man. It was like, you know, he was developing this original style that expressed the time and also doesn't sound dated, you know, like we were talking about. He was too smart to create anything that would sound dated or gimmicky. And Mark Neese wrote on his ballot, maybe the one of the greatest album openers of all time. So
yeah, it's pretty great,
right? Yeah, when you lead off with the title track and it's this good, yeah, that's pretty.
I'll also say this: I don't care what year it is. You play this at midnight on New Year's Eve, New Year's Anytime. Day, whatever switches over. It's just perfect. It doesn't matter what year it is. Right. It holds up. It's just a great tune. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're trying to fool your kids on New Year's Eve and you put the clocks ahead, you just put this on and everyone will go to bed.
That's right. After that. All right. That's a good stopping point for today.
Yeah.
Three songs, the countdown per episode this week. So that means we are now headed into the top 6 by my math, starting with tomorrow.
I think that's right. Yeah. 3 per. We're going to get there.
All right. So you're not going to want to miss that.
Mm-mm.
So come back tomorrow. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you then.
I mean, Jody's wearing the hat with the symbol on it, and suddenly he made himself a symbol. Like, no one has ever done that. Like, not even Elvis, right, could make himself a symbol and make people recognize it.